Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Last week, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources sponsored the 17th annual Project Aware. A group of volunteers paddles down an Iowa river, picking up trash along the way. This year, they paddled down the Boone River, Goldfield to Boone Forks Wildlife Area, 61 miles, and a whole lot of trash along the way. Wildlife biologist Jim Peace stopped by Project Aware this year. He's also stopped by the studio today. Hello, Jim.
Hello.
Thanks for not bringing trash with you.
Well, I have a car full. Definitely a lot of trash. It's amazing. This whole Project Aware to me is... these folks are really crazy. It's just great. You know, these people are passionate about Iowa rivers, both the volunteers and the folks who organize it. And while it used to be organized by employees of the DNR, it's now organized by some former employees that are now retired from the DNR, but they are still organizing this Project Aware. DNR is involved in a small way, but it's really volunteers
driven by their passion
that run this, organized to an unbelievable degree. This is not chaos. You would think that you've got 200 plus people getting in canoes and going down river. You think it would be totally chaotic, but they have it so well organized. It is amazing. It's safe. It is. Volunteers are all well-fed. There are programs in the evening. That's one of the things that I did. I went not only to paddle for a day, but then I went along and I was asked to come and speak to them. So I thought, well, I'll paddle for the day. And I was so impressed. It was just amazing. Now, in lots of ways, speaking to this group is like preaching to the choir, of course.
Right.
You know, 'cause they really have... they have a passion like I do for Iowa rivers, but they are out there. It's hot. It's a lot of work. They're digging out things like refrigerators, filled with mud for probably a couple of decades.
Right?
And they're digging these all out. Tires, et cetera, et cetera. It's amazing.
Describe the volunteers for me, because this is an incredibly diverse group of people that comes out to participate.
Yeah, they range from age 2 to age 78. So there are an awful lot of people in the, I would say, 30 to 50-year-old age range, lots of folks. A lot of families bring their kids along. A significant number of folks my age and older, which was very good to see, other gray-headed folks out there. And it's an amazing experience. So there were this year, about 350 participants for the event.
And some people don't stay the whole week.
No, a lot of people don't. But they're on average, every day of the week, they had 216 people on the river each day. So, significant number of people do stay the whole week. They spend their vacations. They take their vacation. They pay to go, which accounts for the food and tents and that sort of thing, and then work all week really hard. And they love the camaraderie, and you could just feel that energy among the people. It was really a spectacular event. It's really good. I hope that it doesn't get too much bigger, because I think the logistics become a problem for them. But I love to see people. They had 130 or so people that were new to Aware this year, which is good. So you need some new volunteers. For those of us who are growing older or can't take that vacation every year to do that, I think it's good to have new people coming in. So about a third of the people were new. That's good.
Some of the stuff that they're pulling out of the river, as you said, are like refrigerators. I mean, some things are really big. How do they move all that trash?
It is amazing. They sometimes move them by canoe. There are no other boats on the, well, there are occasionally a few kayaks, but kayaks aren't really helpful because you can't haul large trash on them. So they'll for some of the very large things, you actually lash canoes together and move down. So you've got two canoes supporting a large piece of metal, a refrigerator, a tractor tire, whatever. There are some things, of course, you can't put in canoes. I was witness to some young men, strong and full of testosterone, wanting to get this engine, V8 engine that they'd found in the mud along the river, and they really wanted to get it into the canoe. And I said, you know, guys, we might want to think about this a little bit. You know, this is I'm not sure if you can't. The four of you can't lift it. I don't think the canoe is going to support it either. And they actually couldn't. It turned out to be too long to fit between the thwarts of the canoe, so they ended up leaving it. But to a lot of their chagrin, they we really wanted to get. And I agree, it's wonderful to get that stuff off the river, but some things are not possible.
Can't do it. Well, and as you're floating down the river and seeing this trash, it's also a history lesson, isn't it?
It is. It's a history lesson, and you see this when you paddle rivers, especially in the spring and the fall, when there's not so much vegetation covering stuff. I think often when we paddle in the middle of the summer, vegetation covers up a lot of these history of the river and how we used to treat rivers. You know, it was very common in the 20s and 30s to pile old cars along a river edge. And they called it riprap, supposedly, you know, keeping the river from the river banks from eroding. But it was just a way to get rid of waste cars is what it was. And that's a shame. Some of those are still there. In different places along many of our rivers across the state, we'll see a short section that still has these old cars, you know, in the bank, and you can see portions of them. And you wonder, of course, what happened to the oil that was in there, all of the materials that were in that car. It's in the river, and unfortunately,
it's in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe if it went that far. You'll see other things too. We commonly used rivers as the dumping ground. Mm-hmm. If you look back at in the first half of the century, when a guy by the name of an Iowan by the name of Ding Darling did his cartoons of his political cartoons, he was a cartoonist for the Des Moines Register, for those of our listeners who don't know, and he was also the first head of what became the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the Franklin Roosevelt administration. But a lot of his cartoons were conservation-oriented, and he was hard on people. He lived on the river, on the Des Moines River, right above in downtown, or in Des Moines. He lived on a bluff above the river, and he was really hard on both urban and rural populations for the way we were treating rivers. In those years, before the days of the Clean Water Act, all of our sewage, one of the reasons we lived along rivers was that rivers took things away, you know, wherever that magical away is. And they would, our sewers ran directly into the river. Industries pumped all of their sewage right into the river. And that's the way we treated them. And so it's not out of the question to see the remnants of that sort of treatment. Cars along the river, lots of landowner dumps along the river where things like refrigerators and old wire, et cetera, were all just sort of dumped in the ditch.
Right, and I'm sure many, many smaller things as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And then we find some, of course, modern trash as well. Beer drinkers who can carry their cans in full and drink them on the river, but that can't seem to carry them out empty. I've never quite understood that. It didn't make any sense to me, but seems to be a fair bit of that.
Yeah.
And it's usually, you don't find a lot of craft beer bottles on the river. This is really, you know, cheap, what I call lawnmower beer. two brands that particularly show up, but we won't advertise them here. But there's a lot of cheap beer cans along the river as well. And that's more modern trash. So we're still treating rivers not as
trash
well as
receptacles.
Yeah.
Although, of course, there are laws in place that prevent us from doing some of the large scale.
Right. Right. Fortunately, we passed Clean Water Act and several amendments to it over the years. And the Clean Water Act really, and I really have to credit Ding Darling with a lot of that early pressure. I mean, it's amazing what he's done for this country. And the Clean Water Act, while it wasn't passed while he was still a political cartoonist, that influence was still very, very strong, I think, in passing the Clean Water. And the Clean Water Act helped us clean up urban areas, especially. It said, thou shalt not pump sewage into the river without treating it. It has to be treated. The Clean Water Act provided lots of funding for towns and cities to treat their sewage through primary and secondary treatment plants. They got forgivable loans from the federal government to do this. They were often matched by state funds, and that's why we have sewage treatment plants today. But one of the things that the Clean Water Act did not do is the other thing that Ding Darling attacked was rural pollution as well, particularly soil. But he was also aware of the farm chemicals that were coming into our rivers. The Clean Water Act exempted agriculture from most of the provisions of the Clean Water Act. And so we still have the problem, as we know, we discussed on this program, and it's been discussed, continues to be discussed around the state in many, many venues. We still have lots of problems with other chemicals. We also have the problem, and we'll talk about this a little later, the problem of chemicals that come out of our bodies, pharmaceuticals, caffeine, as I drink my coffee, and other things that aren't removed by the sewage treatment process. And when those get into the water, we're just beginning to understand what some of the impacts are on aquatic life. It's a really difficult thing to separate, because you don't know what concentrations, how they combine. There are all sorts of problems, and we'll talk some more about that later in the program. But I think it's a legacy that we continue to, particularly Project Aware is cleaning up that legacy.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, also Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. We're talking about our waterways today, and we'll continue that conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We've been talking about rivers and streams so far this hour, inspired by the 17th annual Project Aware, which took place last week as a large group of volunteers paddled down the Boone River Goldfield to Boone Forks Wildlife Area, 61 miles, and picked up how many tons of trash?
Oh, this is amazing. So there were 14.3 tons of trash removed in that 60 miles of river.
Wow.
Included in that were 262 tires. Now, the water level was somewhat high, not super high, so it was dangerous or anything, but high enough where there weren't a lot of, you weren't having areas where there are lots of sandbars and river bottom visible. So most of the stuff was picked up on the side. I suspect as the water level goes down this week, if the Project Aware had been on the Boone 2 weeks later, or even maybe a few weeks earlier, they'd have picked up even more tires and more junk in the river itself. A lot of this came from the side, but we're talking over 14 tons of trash, much of which was the biggest single amount was steel. About 90% of that was scrap metal of various kinds. And that includes things like refrigerators, lots and lots. This was a wired week, as it were. There was lots and lots of old hog wire and barbed wire fencing rolls that the local landowner had taken out and just thrown in the ditch along the river. And that's unfortunate, but So these volunteers cleaned up one heck of a lot of trash. 14 tons. That's amazing. Just amazing.
That is incredible. And I know you're not one of the organizers of Project Aware. Is the 17th year. Do they ever revisit rivers that they've done before?
They do. They do go back to rivers occasionally. And it's amazing as rivers, go through flood and drought and everything, they uncover more stuff from the past. Sometimes a flood will uncover even older artifacts, things, bison bones and elk antlers that have fossilized or semi-fossilized.
The Devonian fossil gorge.
Right, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. So they actually open up some older waste sites as well. But humans have been doing this for a long time. but they also then uncover things from year to year that weren't visible the last time they were through. So, yeah, they do revisit some stretches of often the same river, different stretch of the river, though. So.
When you visited Project Aware last week, you were one of the presenters. You gave a program, and you took a little different approach to your program than you've done in other situations. Because as you mentioned, you're talking to a group of people who are obviously knowledgeable. Most of them are quite knowledgeable about our waterways and committed to cleaning up our waterways. Tell me what you did.
Well, I've been giving this talk on Iowa River, reflections on Iowa rivers and their futures to a variety of people all over the state. And in fact, I'm giving it to a national audience on Friday. I'll be presenting to the national convention of the Isaac Walton League on Friday. Great opportunity. But I thought with this, folks, these people are comparative experts, compared to, normal everyday Iowans, because these people have spent a lot of time in the river, some of them for 17 years have been on Project Aware, they know a lot about it. So I presented a little bit, but then I gave them some problem statements, statements about what I see as some of the major problems, not the only problems, but some of the major problems along our rivers, and then asked them to divide up into small groups, five, six people. And for each problem, that they might take one statement and work with it. They had all of 10 minutes to solve these problems, But they then presented the problems. And it was really interesting hearing them talk among themselves, because initially it was like they'd read the problem statement aloud to the rest of the group, and then they would start talking about it. And I asked them to think about, there were several questions, but asked them to think about what are some of the alternatives for solving this particular problem. Who might oppose that your solutions, and who might support them solutions in our society? And then where do we find the money if money is involved for doing that? And those are the kinds of questions, of course, that we deal with every day. I gave them an example.
Conservation's policymakers.
Right. Policymakers in particular and people in agencies have to deal with. And it's not easy. Even within this group of the choir, there were often disputes about how these, even within 10 minutes, it was really interesting to watch. It was exactly what I expected. Different people would have different approaches. Some would say, this ought to be a voluntary effort. And others would say, nope, we ought to pass a law. And I'd say, well, okay, who's going to enforce the law? They'll do it because it's a law. It doesn't always work that way, unfortunately. So I wish it did.
Right. Well, and that harkens back to the earlier part of our conversation, that although there are stronger laws protecting our rivers now than there used to be, a lot of people continue to abuse those.
That's
because
right.
Enforcement is nearly impossible.
Nearly impossible. Right. Nearly impossible to... enforce all the laws, just the littering laws. I mean, who's going to enforce them out there on the rivers? It's pretty difficult to do unless a conservation officer or someone else who's on the river specifically to enforce the laws sees it. It's not going to happen. So, yeah, it's a very difficult thing. We depend a lot on people following the law in our society because it's the law. But I think we also depend, especially when it comes to our rivers, we depend upon people's relationship to that resource. We depend on the ethics that they have in order to do the right thing. We're not always sure, of course, what is the right thing.
Right.
And one of the issues that I presented them with was, in fact, this whole issue of chemicals and how we can overcome that. We talked about, for example, earlier, I'm trying to find the problem statement here. Oh, I said, so sewage treatment for cities and towns is mandatory thanks to the Clean Water Act, preventing untreated human and industrial waste from entering our rivers. But that treatment doesn't remove everything. So we talked about earlier, pesticides from lawns and fields, salt from the roads, caffeine and pharmaceutical runoff from our bodies are still running into our rivers and streams. Some research has demonstrated that some chemicals have interactions. And this happens. It happens in upstate New York. There's at least one river, probably more, where all the fish are male. And it has to do with the synergism, the interaction between various pharmaceuticals that come out of our bodies that are in the river water. And the fish have become all male, which is a disturbing
right. And obviously it has
fish.
Right. It has definite implications for future generations or no generations at all.
Exactly. Exactly. So I said, so should we impose new requirements for sewage treatment on towns and cities across the state? And some said, well, yeah, we should. But of course, we don't always know how to remove those chemicals. And it can be extremely expensive. We know, for example, the city of Des Moines, just removing a chemical we know how to remove, nitrates from river water so that it makes it drinkable for 500,000 citizens in central Iowa, we know that that's a very expensive process. They spend, I think the figures last I saw were $1.5 million a year on a $9 million system just to remove the nitrates from that water.
And of course, we know if we followed the news over the last few years, the late Bill Stowe
right.
Made a big issue out of that because there's a city bearing the brunt of the cost for
right.
removing chemicals that are in the water
right.
that they didn't place there.
Right, exactly. And Bill, for whether you liked what he did or thought it was right or not, for our listeners, he certainly woke people up to the issue. And I think that was an incredible service to the people of Iowa. And now we, as a society, have to come together to figure out how to solve these problems. Well, this particular problem, for example, I said, even if we assume we can remove such things, like caffeine, for example, the coffee that I'm drinking, mm-hmm. later I will get rid of some of that caffeine. Who should pay for it and how? Do we do it through taxes? Do we do it through special assessments on coffee? I don't know. You know, those are the kinds of things we as a society have to decide. I think we've done this before, and I'll point out a little in the third part of the program how we have solved some problems. I think we're making progress towards some of these. But this particular one, we have a lot of research to do to understand even the interactions of some of these chemicals in aquatic systems, let alone how they impact aquatic life and may affect our lives down the road.
It's interesting to hear you talk about it because when I hear you talking about those questions, I hear the kinds of questions we were asking about climate change 15 years ago.
Yeah,
it feels like this is a problem that we're going to understand better in the future and maybe understand the magnitude in a really scary way.
But only if we find funds somehow, public, private, or some combination, more likely thereof, to fund the research that happens. Unless that research is funded, unless researchers can have access to funding to make that happen, we won't solve those problems. And that's the critical thing. You have to admit that there's a problem, A, or a potential problem, and B, find a way to help scientists do their work. And that's something I think we're lacking at the current time.
We are talking about our waterways, some of the big issues and small issues that create challenges for water quality in Iowa and elsewhere. Jim Pease is my guest, wildlife biologist, and you're welcome to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Your observations of the rivers over the years and what you've seen, good or bad, how you've seen things change, maybe your thoughts about things that we should do to make things better. 866-780-9100. So in presenting a group of people with that, there are a lot of difficult problems on the list that you gave me. But I mean, that one in particular seems really tricky because it doesn't feel like a priority right now, given, you know, maybe that's a smoldering pile of ash where we have a lot of things on fire over there.
You bet.
So what kind of answers did you get from people?
Well, it was interesting because I think given more time, and I plan to use the same technique with some larger groups and where they do have more time, I think as a society, we can solve some of these problems. Maybe not all of them, but we can solve some of these problems. But we have to want to solve them. And I think about, I told them about a problem we had back in the 1960s and 70s. Growing up as a kid in southeastern Iowa, my younger brother and I used to go down and watch the eagles in the wintertime along the river, fish in the open water areas where the electrical plant would push their cooling water out back into the river. So it kept the ice open in the wintertime. But all we saw were adult eagles. We only saw adult bald eagles. Why? Because in the 1950s and 60s, DDT was a real problem, and eagle populations, along with peregrine falcons, brown pelicans, et cetera, a whole bunch of other birds that were at the top of the food chain, those populations were decreasing. There was no recruitment, no young eagles or eaglets coming into the population because DDT, through a complex process, would thin the shells of the eggs and they would not hatch. So there were no young eagles coming into the population. 1973, we made a very difficult decision. DDT was a very popular chemical.
Very useful. Yeah.
And this is, what was that, 73? It was 7 years after Rachel Carson, who had revealed the problem to the world, had died of cancer. We banned the chemical. It was amazing. And now, a few years after that, we had the first eagles nesting. And by 1978, 79, we had our first eagle nest back in Iowa. 80 years absent from the state of Iowa. We had the first eagle nest in 1978 or 79 on the Mississippi. And as a young biologist, I thought, oh, we'll have, you know, maybe a handful of nests eventually along the Mississippi, maybe along the Missouri. Boy, was I wrong. Eagles responded to that lack of DDT. We now have over 400 eagle nests in the state of Iowa. We see eagles every day. If you're looking, you can often see them along all of our interior rivers, not just along the Mississippi and the Missouri, all of our interior rivers.
Creeks, too.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just amazing. So, and I hope I've told young people that I've talked to about this, I said, don't take it for granted, because it can go the other way very quickly. And, you know, we see things happening within eagle populations that we never expected to happen. Because now they're common, if you will.
Right. You know, well, so eagles not reproducing. Eagles are a national symbol. They're beautiful. They're visible. They're, as you like to say, charismatic megafauna.
Right.
Something that it's easy to get people to care about. It's hard to get people to care about a river full of male fish.
It is. They're out of sight, out of mind. And we have to have that same sort of passionate response to the small things that are there, that are the canaries in the coal mine for us, that warn us about problems within the river system. And there are lots of canaries here. I think they're all cheeping pretty loudly, but we have to listen. And we have to decide as a society that we're willing to find the solutions, potential solutions, and to fund them somehow, and to make a commitment to do that. That takes a national commitment. Not everybody's going to be happy, but we're going to have good results. I think our rivers are amazingly resilient if we allow them to be, and we do the right things along the way to make that happen. But it's going to take some tough decisions as a society. Now, whether we do that through the political process or the regulatory process, whatever, or through individual action, some combination of those, I think remains to be seen. But we have to decide as a society that we're going to solve some of these problems. And that was the message I was bringing to them. We have to make some decisions, and we shouldn't be afraid of those decisions because we've done it before. We've been able, and DDT is a prime example.
So that gives you hope?
It does. It does. And that's the kind of thing that I've seen in speaking to a wide variety of groups. I see a lot of hope out there. I think people are really beginning. And Bill Stowe was one of those people that helped us think about some of these tough issues.
Started some conversations, very heated conversations.
You bet.
All right, yeah. We are going to take a short break. We will be back in just a moment. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about our waters in Iowa, streams and rivers, some of the big challenges facing water quality in Iowa. And you're welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about water quality in Iowa, Iowa's rivers and streams. With me, Jim Pease, Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. And Jim, we've been talking about a program that you gave last week when you stopped by Project Aware. You presented the people who were at your program with some big problems and some smaller problems that are facing Iowa rivers and streams and lakes, and asked for them to come up with some solutions. And you found that there wasn't necessarily a great deal of agreement, even among people who admitted that there were problems and that these problems were important,
right.
As far as solutions came. And what did you want people to take away from that exercise?
Well, I want them to understand first that there are a variety of approaches to these problems. And it's one of the reasons we have disagreements in the legislature and at the state and the federal level, even on the local level, at the Board of Supervisors level. There are differences of opinion how to solve these human problems that we have. And I wanted them to see that we need to, that not everybody's going to be happy when we propose some solutions, and we have to deal with those criticisms of our solutions. And if we deal with those, again, we're not necessarily going to end up happy, but I think we'll end up pretty much in the right place if we allow that process of coming to societal solutions to these big problems. Now, I think I told them in the end that I don't know of any single large societal or environmental problem that has been solved. It has to be solved by some combination of public laws and rules and money and private ethics, private money. All these problems have been solved by some combination of that public-private. We can't depend on government to do everything. We can't depend on voluntary efforts to do everything because humans are greedy. We just are.
There's psychology to it,
right.
But then there's also business problems.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you
Absolutely.
Choose to take voluntary efforts and you are cutting your profits and your competition is not doing the same thing. I mean, this is
you put yourself at a disadvantage.
Right. It's
right.
not so, a simple
right. no.
thing.
And that's what I want them to see, that these are complex problems. It seems sometimes, I think when you're on one side of an issue or another, it seems like, gee, it's a simple solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that simple. But we still have to solve it, and we have to figure out how to solve that.
Give me just a very quick rundown of the other problems you threw out to the people who were at Project Aware.
Yeah, one of the things I talked about were storm sewers. In cities, those still run. Those are not covered by the Clean Water Act. They still run directly into our streams and rivers. And if you've ever participated in any kind of a river cleanup, you see what comes out of car doors, out of yards, off the streets, all of our parking lots and streets and everything, those run directly into our streams and rivers. So that was one problem. How do we reduce or eliminate the problem? Number two was channelized rivers. Lots of our rivers were channelized, straightened, if you will.
I remember very clearly in the 80s watching that happen all over the place.
It was especially done in the early half of the century, but it was still happening in the 70s and some of it in the 80s. Those straightened rivers have very little habitat along them. They make the water go away quickly,
right.
But that just means downriver has more water to deal with than they can deal with. So there are lots of problems. So should we allow rivers to reconnect with their floodplains? Well, what about the farms, the homes, the businesses, the buildings, the roads that are on those floodplains? How do we protect that infrastructure, or do we? Do we buy it out? Thirdly, Iowa was once dotted with lots of shallow water wetlands, and now we have the problems of nitrates because we drained those wetlands.
Almost all of our fields are tiled.
All of them are tiled. They carry with them chemicals that are in those waters, including especially nitrogen, like we've talked about, but also other chemicals as well. How do we decrease those nitrogen levels in our rivers, and who should pay for it? Those are tough questions.
Right, very tough.
Yeah, and those are exactly what we're dealing with, though. We certainly have the nitrogen reduction strategy, which is written to try to help solve that, but we're not there yet.
And has been a voluntary approach.
Right. Yeah, it's totally voluntary. Exactly. We're an agricultural state. We're always going to be. Livestock is allowed legally to graze along and actually in the streams. And if you've been a paddler on many of our Iowa streams, you might have had to paddle over a fence or under an electric fence. And I've gotten my paddle caught on one of those. It's a little, you know,
jarring,
shocking. Yes.
Shocking. What an interesting word.
So how do we get what kinds of practices will allow us to keep livestock out of the water but still have access to water for watering, and who owns the stream, et cetera, et cetera. Some of the problems there. Number five was erosion of stream banks along our rivers continue to contribute large amounts of soil into our rivers, more so now coming from the banks themselves as coming off the croplands and other lands above it. So how do we slow down the erosion along the banks of rivers without making them ugly? I talked about how, and there were sections of the Boone that are, you know, for many years they were dumping highway departments, both at the state and the county level, were dumping waste cement. Now, fortunately, that cement is recycled a lot for the base of new roads, and that's a nice solution. So there's not as much cement available. But it made those river edges look very industrial and very ugly and very hard to get access the river because it's all jagged cement and everything. So how do we do that without making them ugly? So we want to slow down the erosion, but we don't want to make them ugly in the process. So are there vegetative methods? And yes, there are. Turns out there are a lot of emerging sorts of things we can do. Number six was dams on our rivers. How do we remove dams without sacrificing their value to those who currently live along them, above the rivers? And we've seen some solutions, and one of the things that people brought up, because they were from parts of the state where they'd seen Manchester, Iowa, for example, where they've created created a series of runs through there. So they improved the fishery, improved the paddling, made it much safer in the river, and still maintained that water level at the top level. So and the new businesses as a result, new opportunities. So it was a win-win sort of situation. Seventh, I talked about large flood events. And because we tended to build on the floodplains, you think about Iowa Falls, Cedar Rapids. Those are called that because they were along rivers. And humans, both Native Americans and Euro-Americans, We settled along rivers because they provided lots of things for us, from power and fish and wildlife and transportation, to they took that waste away,
right.
You know. So all of those things were, every major town or city is dealing now with more frequent floods. And so should we forbid building on the floodplains? Of more frequently flooded streams or rivers? Should we discourage farming in the floodplains? Should we allow those floodplains to be exactly that, floodplains, a place where the river goes, and therefore solve the problems of buying or of paying for reconstructing towns and cities along those rivers every time? And we do that over and over and over. Another problem was dealing with floods, but the kinds of things that they the kinds of things that homeowners along the river like to do.
We have a lot of people who want to get in on this conversation, although you were going to say we've got lawns that go right down to the water's edge,
right?
Because it looks beautiful.
It looks beautiful, and they love the river. But what happens is that the water's not allowed as it flows down that lawn to sink in to the into the soil very slowly. So you have to slow down that water. So don't mow clear down to the edge. Well, how do we make that possible? One of the solutions I came up with, of course, was a lot of education.
Right.
A lot of landowners just don't know. So yeah.
And are well-meaning.
Right.
Here's an email from Ellen. Caffeine in my water I'm not concerned about, but nitrates and coliform bacteria are the big threat. Closed beaches and cancer risks are realities. Plenty of research shows what needs to be done to mitigate agriculture runoff. The DNR and EPA just need to hold agriculture responsible for their pollution. I know a lot of people feel the same way as Ellen.
Yeah.
I mean, you're saying it is more complicated.
It is. And if you read the nutrient reduction strategy, you'll see how complicated it can be. Now, I would agree with her. We need to have the federal government through the EPA hold us responsible for what we're doing to our rivers. I agree 100%. How do we do that? Is it just a matter of saying, thou shalt not? It's not that easy. We have to find solutions that are affordable. We still have to, it is an agricultural state. We've got to find ways to do that. But we worry about those things because we're swimming in the water. The E. coli she mentioned and the nitrates in the water. I agree. Those are big problems. But these other chemicals I'm talking about are the problems of the future. I don't think we can afford to ignore them, even though the other problems right now certainly need to be solved. I would agree with that. But we can't ignore these other problems, too.
Here's a comment from Cindy, and I don't expect you to answer this question, but I think it's one a lot of people ask. She says, social media can bring people together to care about rivers, but social media also makes it much easier to spread misinformation about potential solutions to river problems.
True.
How do we make social media a force for progress and not a force for denial and inaction? That is too big a question
to
answer.
Question. Yeah.
If you know the answer, Jim, I'd love to hear it, but I think we're going to move on to taking some calls. Dave is on the line with us from Des Moines. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I grew up on America's dirtiest river, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio.
Yes.
And large sections, if people aren't familiar, real quick, it burned. There were so many petrochemicals poured into that river from agriculture, from industry. The runoff was horrible. We didn't know it at the time. We swam in it as kids.
And it hasn't affected you a bit, huh?
But I just want to say that once Ohio collectively decided that we were going to clean it up because we were such a disgrace to the country, we did. And now it is a beautiful, wonderful river, and rivers will heal themselves.
Yeah.
It just takes the collective will of the people to do it.
You got
it. Thank you.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for your call.
That's exactly right.
I also covered
collective will.
Right. I covered the restoration of the River Rouge in Michigan when I lived in Michigan, a very similar problem. Also, that river burned. But
maybe it's national embarrassment we need.
Right. Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. I would hope that we don't have to light things on fire.
Oh, right. Right.
For us to respond.
Well, and
a lot of these problems are things that are hard to see.
they're hard to see, and yet we need to see them, and we need to be embarrassed by them. I think that's one of the things that Bill Stowe did by bringing that problem. The Des Moines Water Works brought that problem forward to the state. That became a national news because a city was suing counties upstream, saying, "Hey, this is our water too. You are responsible for polluting our water." That's a national issue. That's a huge issue. And I had friends, colleagues in other states on the coast calling me saying, "What's going on in Iowa? We ought to be embarrassed by it, and we ought to find ways." And maybe, I hope it doesn't take national embarrassment to solve these problems like the Cuyahoga did, and the Rouge, was it?
Yeah.
Hopefully we, he's right though. It's collectively we have to decide as a society to solve these problems. We can't just say, "Oh, the EPA should do it." You know, that's pushing it off. The EPA is us. We're the government, and we ought to be able to solve these problems. If we emasculate our agencies, our resource agencies, as we've done in Iowa here, by underfunding them, by making the agency political appointments rather than scientists who are doing their jobs. By doing those sorts of things, we make it impossible to solve, to act as a society. I think those are the kinds of things we have to come to some agreement on. And if we're going to solve these problems, we have to act collectively and say, nope, we're not going to elect people who don't support environmental cleanup. And we have to help them find solutions to all of these problems.
So many of these issues, you know, we all interact with the water. We are all polluters.
Mm.
There are things that we can do to mitigate our own personal impact on the water. And of course, you had, you know, a couple of hundred volunteers floating
right.
down the Boone River doing
right.
their best to help clean it up. But it can feel really helpless. It feels like my efforts are meaningless.
Well, they're not. Again, it's a collective process, but it begins at the individual level. Things like using a reusable water bottle rather than buying plastic bottles of water at the store. We're talking ocean pollution here mm-hmm. that is unbelievable. These huge people have seen these huge garbage dumps. We have the same thing on our rivers. Storm sewers in low water flow, low rain, tend to collect some of that stuff off the streets, and then it comes out in a big rain event. I've paddled along the Cedar River, as a matter of fact, after one of these rain events, and a big plug of garbage, a big raft of garbage came out of it. It's disgusting to paddle along this raft of garbage that came out of the storm sewer system. And some of it was plastic bottles and styrofoam cups and et cetera, et cetera. So it collects together, and collectively we can, the decisions we make individually collectively make a difference in the long run. It does seem overwhelming, but individuals can have a huge impact. And I think demanding of our leaders at the local, at the state, and at the federal level, demanding that, letting them know that water quality is a real issue that concerns you as one of their constituents, and that you think it ought to be. You're willing to help clean it up, and you expect them to vote properly. I think those kinds of issues need to be communicated to all of those who are running for office,
Jim
who represent
Pease.
Us.
Yeah. So. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jim Pease, Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.